Hey, welcome to the Get to Know Nashville podcast. My name is Josh Kennedy. This is episode 6. And this week we're speaking with author, speaker, podcaster, blogger, Jeff Goines. Jeff is the best-selling author of 5 books, including The Art of Work and Real Artists Don't Starve. He has an amazing heart for creatives, and we had a great time chatting with him about facing your fears and finding your calling. Also, be sure to check out the video of our interview available at gtkn.tv. If you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcast app and tell your friends. We really appreciate it. Now let's go to the interview with Jeff.
All right, so let's start with something real easy. If you remember, look at me.
Yes.
Or past me.
Uh-huh. And look at me.
Let's start by just saying, say your name and what you do.
Okay.
And maybe where you're from, if you want to throw that in.
I'm Jeff Goines, and I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois. I live in Franklin, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville, and I'm a writer, and I write books and help other writers through online courses.
Perfect. So when did you know that you wanted to be an author, a writer?
Mm-hmm.
How early on was that? Let's talk about that a little bit.
I knew that I wanted to be a writer. I don't know, a long, long time ago. I think most dreams, you get them early on, then you forget them, then you remember them. So the first time I knew was probably when I was a kid, writing short stories and making my own comic books when, I don't know, I was 10, 11 years old. When I was 12 years old, I won the school spelling bee, and that felt pretty good. And then at some point, I kind of forgot that and remembered it probably when I was around 27. I was a marketing director at a nonprofit, and I started a blog, and I started sharing my writing with the world, and people started to listen and connect with it, and I thought maybe I could do something with it.
Cool. So some of my questions might double back to some things that you touch on, but so early on, I mean, you covered a lot of years there,
yeah,
I'm sure. So early on, did you have doubts about being a professional writer and doing that for a living? Like when you started your blog and that type of, like, was there doubts early on about becoming a writer?
Yeah, early on, I did have doubts and questions, and I still have doubts. I can't believe people make money doing this sort of thing, writing words and sharing them on the internet, writing books, making stuff up and people paying you for it. It's incredible. It's magic. I love it. But yeah, early on, I did have some insecurities and doubts that I just had to work through. What really forced me to do this kind of work in the first place and start trying to make some money off of it was my wife was pregnant with our first kid. We both were working full-time jobs. We were doing fine, making ends meet. But we really couldn't afford for her to not work, and that was ideal. That's what we wanted, was for her to stay home and help raise our baby boy for a little while. And we just couldn't afford for that to happen. And I had this writing habit, this hobby, that I thought, can I make any money off of it? And so I do like to say that I wouldn't be a writer or an entrepreneur or a business owner if I first didn't become a dad. It really did force me to think about something more than myself, bigger than myself, bigger than just what I was doing at the time. And so I think life has a way of forcing you to push past your doubts because something bigger than you, bigger than your fear or concerns about yourself, is calling you to kind of step up. And so that's what I had to do.
Cool. We can relate.
Of course, yeah. Once you have to do it, you have to do it.
Yeah. So I know you had your blog. Aside from your blog, and maybe that was the main source of this, but what did you do early on to kind of hone that craft? And how did you use your blog and build followers and just talk about the process of building your blog to what it is today?
Yeah, I remember starting out early on with a lot of questions, a lot of doubts, and a formative conversation for me was when I was talking to a friend of mine. And he asked me what my dream was. And I said, I don't have one of those. And he said, really? I would have thought that your dream was to be a writer. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I guess I'd like to be a writer someday. And he didn't know me that well. We hadn't been friends that long. And he just looked at me and he said, Jeff, you are a writer. You just need to write. And that was really powerful for me to realize I already was this thing that I wanted to be. I just needed to do it. And from that conversation, I kind of built a framework, a way to think about myself and about my work. And I learned that activity follows identity. Before you can go do something, you have to become someone. And so for me, I stopped saying, I'd like to be a writer someday, and I started calling myself a writer. And people would go, okay, great, what have you written? And I would go, oh my gosh, I better go write something. You know, it forced me to actually do the work. And so the first thing I did was I started calling myself a writer. And then because that I was putting myself out there, I felt like I had to earn it. I had to earn that title. And so it kind of forced me to build a daily writing habit. And I used my blog as a place to share what I was working on. And I did this for about 2 years. And before that, I'd spent 9 years trying to do this with other various failed projects. But this was a new project. It's a blog I have today. And it really started with this idea that this is just a place to practice, right? Like, I don't know, kids shooting hoops in some like public park. If you get good enough, somebody might eventually notice you. And for me, I think of that as practicing in public. If I'm going to practice, I might as well do it someplace where if I get good enough and somebody notices me, that could lead to something. And so my blog, even to this day, is a place where I practice trying things out, growing as a writer, sharing ideas, and seeing what resonates.
A lot of your books come from blogs originally, like just ideas that you practice in your blog?
Yeah, I read something from an author one time, and he said, this is where the ideas start before they become books. And I think everything I'm doing starts on the blog, on social media, in a way where I'm just simply sharing an idea, trying to get feedback, rarely saying I'm working on a book, but just kind of throwing stuff out there. And I don't even know if it's a book, but it's something that I'm interested in, something that I'm curious about. And if I see other people resonating with it, they get excited about something that I'm already excited about, I go, great, let's chase that for a while. So yeah, all the books started out as a blog post, an article, an idea somewhere where I was sharing it with at least a handful of people.
Do you remember any specific blog post that launched The Art of Work or Real Arsenal Star? Something that like sparked, got a lot of comments or feedback or shares and like, okay, there's something. Do you remember a specific blog post or anything?
Yeah, I wrote an article for my blog, and then it also ended up getting syndicated on Medium and some other places the truth about why creative people succeed, the hard truth about how creative people succeed, something like that. And it was essentially about networks and relationships and how success is not just about skill, it's also about who you know. And that blew up to both positive and negative reaction, where people were like, this isn't fair. I'm like, you're absolutely right, it's not fair. So like, start meeting people. But it had been my experience where creative success, being a professional artist, musician, writer, et cetera, it's important to be good at what you do. It's also important to be connected with the right people who can help you succeed. And that became an idea that was represented in the book, Real Artists Don't Starve. That there were lots of iterations of that, but yeah, I love this story about the young actor and the old actor in Hollywood. The young actor says, the old actor, man, I'm just waiting for my big break. And the old actor says to the young actor, kid, it's not about the one big break, it's about the 50 big breaks. So I think there's some truth to that. It's not about one thing that happened, but a bunch of things that all need to happen and that you can help happen that lead to success. But the first big thing that happened to me probably was meeting one of my heroes, one of my idols, a man named Michael Hyatt, who's a blogger, author, entrepreneur. He was the CEO of a publisher at the time, and I read his blog. I looked up to him. He lived here in Nashville. And I reached out to him and asked him if we could get together for coffee, and he said yes. And we kept meeting, we kept talking, I kept learning from him about writing, publishing, marketing, blogging. He was a good friend of me, great mentor, still is to this day. And that relationship opened up a lot of opportunities for me. that wouldn't have otherwise existed, at least the way they came about. So that thing led to another thing and another thing and so on. But that was a big deal. And I remember, we had this friendship kind of develop from 2011 to 2012. So I would email him about once a week with a question and he'd respond to it. And I would like go do whatever that thing was. And it wasn't a formal like coaching thing, but it kind of turned into that. And I remember one week I was blogging daily. I was writing a new article every single day. And he had tweeted out another link to an article. And it was like the fifth time in a row that he had done that. And this was back in the day when if you tweeted an article, it would send hundreds of people to your website. And I remember sending him a message saying, this is too much. This is overwhelming. You don't have to keep doing this. It's very nice, but you can stop now. Because I was just overwhelmed. And he said, Jeff, I don't know what you're talking about. I want to share good stuff with my audience, and I like your writing. You write good stuff. And there was something really affirming just about that, realizing that this wasn't somebody who's just taking pity on me. I was somebody who saw some skill and talent in me and wanted to encourage it. And yeah, it did help me believe in myself at a time when I didn't fully believe in myself.
Absolutely. That's a cool story. Just real simple. Like, what gets you most excited about what you do?
What gets me most excited about what I do is I love connecting ideas with people. So, I thought selling lots of books would make me happy. And that, that's fine. It helps pay the bills. I thought making money, more money would make me happy. Again, fine. Nothing wrong with that. I would sell a bunch of books and that would be good. And then I would sell more copies of the next book and that felt about the same. I'd make a certain amount of money and that felt pretty good. And then I'd make more and it felt about the same. So I realized, okay, I don't know. Like this, there's got to be another way to measure success other than fame and dollar bills. Again, totally fine. But more of that kind of created diminishing returns for me in terms of joy and satisfaction. So I had to find a different way to measure success other than fame and dollar signs. Again, totally fine, but it just more of that didn't light me up. And for me, when I sit down to write, I'm hoping that it reaches someone. And so when people send me letters, send me emails saying, when I read that line in that book, when I read that blog post, heard that podcast, when you said this thing at that event, that was for me. I love that. And it's a pretty special thing to know that it's not just one to many, you're reaching a bunch of people, but it's one to one and you're saying something that feels important to you and it's connecting to somebody in a significant and impactful way. And so I like that. I like getting up and saying, what am I going to say today? What am I going to share today that's going to resonate with somebody in some way that I can't even imagine? It's exciting, fun work.
That's cool. I can think of when I read The Art of Work, and we'll get into this a little bit later.
Cool.
The whole concept of a portfolio life
That's good. That's great. Yeah.
So that was awesome. Cool. But we'll get into that.
Cool.
All right. So talk about, I'm sure it hasn't been all gravy to get where you're at. Can you talk about some maybe creative challenges or business challenges that you faced along the way? Or maybe one or two specific ones?
Sure. The biggest challenge of this journey for me has been really knowing what I want and being okay with wanting something that doesn't sound particularly exciting or ambitious to someone else. And I think it was in 2015 where I got all these things that I thought I wanted. Made more money than I ever thought I'd make, had a best-selling book, did all these things. And by the end of the year, I just kind of still felt like me. I thought I'd be a different person, I'd feel different. And it was disappointing. I wasn't overwhelmed with success. I wasn't depressed or, my life, I didn't blow my life up. It was just kind of a little bit underwhelming. And what I realized I'd been doing was chasing other people's definitions of success. Certain amount of money, certain amount of fame. All those things are fine, but I was doing what I thought was expected of me. And it didn't make me happy. And so the biggest challenge for me has been to not chase something just because everybody else is chasing it, hustling just because everybody else is hustling, and never being content with where you're at. It seems to be a cool thing to do, and it's never made me happy. And so the best part of the journey has been to be honest with myself about what I want and don't want, and be okay with saying no to everything that is not ultimately what I want.
That's cool. I feel like my wife and I have that conversation all the time.
Of course, every guy who doesn't know who he is thinks something out there is going to make him someone different. Yeah.
So I know one of the things from what I've seen and gathered, one of the things that you're big on is just being willing to help people.
Mm.
For instance,
sure.
Helping us out, being part of this, which is cool. When did you realize that combining helping people with art was kind of a key to your success?
Mm.
Which I've heard you say that directly in podcasts, I think.
So I love the idea of generosity. Because I think all art is inherently generous. Seth Godin talks about this. He calls art a gift. Lewis High talks about it as well in his book called The Gift. And it's the idea that true art, a piece of art, is a gift. And the point of a gift is to keep it moving, like a white elephant gift, or, you know, so that keeps moving. People keep passing it on, but it's actually a gift that you want. And good art is that kind of gift. If you think about it, you read a book and you go, I love, this book was great. Have you read this book? What's it called? Harry Potter. It's great. Go check it out. It keeps moving, right? And there is inherent generosity in it. And maybe it's because I came from the nonprofit world. Maybe it's because I was the recipient of a lot of other people's generosity. And in many ways, those acts of kindness and grace have got me to where I am today. But for whatever reason, I just understood that it's not just about getting people to do things for you, you know, life, creative work. And it's not just about who you know, as people like to say, it's not what you know, it's who you know. It's really about who you help. And if you help enough people in the world, as my dad used to say, what goes around comes around. There's that great Zig Ziglar line. You know, if you help enough people get what they want, they're going to help you get what you want. And it really is that simple.
That's cool. So you've written about having a calling or a purpose in life.
Yes.
Can you describe what that means and how exactly you help others find their calling and purpose?
Calling is this idea that there's something more to life, to your life, right? So I wrote The Art of Work because I kept running into people, all kinds of people, religious people, non-religious people, Christians, atheists, agnostics, it didn't matter. I would talk to people and they would say, I'm doing this, right? I'm working as a bank teller or a lawyer, a videographer, a writer, or whatever, but what I really want to be doing is this. And so there was just this universal sense that who I am and what I do are not the same thing. And so I think of a calling as your life's work. It's why you're here. Maybe it's your job, maybe it's not. But if you die without answering the calling, right? If you end your life without doing this thing, whatever it is, the thing that's on your heart, the thing that you feel like is inside of you that wants to get out into the world, something is going to feel incomplete. And I felt that in my late 20s, fortunately, pretty early on. And I was afraid to make a change because it seemed costly. But on the other side of that fear was everything, you know, a whole different life that I never could have imagined. And there were, you know, challenges and trials as well. But this idea that I've got important work to do in this world, and if I don't do it, nobody will do it, that's a calling.
It's cool. Do you think there are any myths about someone finding their calling?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read about that in the book. One of the biggest myths about answering your calling, finding your purpose, discovering your life's work, however you want to think of it, doesn't matter. One of the biggest myths about this is that you just know. You just know. You know what you're supposed to do. How did you know, grandma was the one. I just knew. That's fine. If you're one of those people that just know what you need to do with your life, that's great. But when I was working on this book, The Art of Work, I didn't just know. I had lots of doubts. And the people that I talked to didn't just know. How do I discover my life's work, my purpose? You just know. It wasn't helpful advice to them. It frustrated them. And it frustrates anybody who feels stuck. So some people just know. A lot of people I found don't know. And I ended up interviewing hundreds of people who had discovered their life's work and asked them, how did you just know? And they all said the same thing. I didn't. I had an idea. I had a thought. I had an itch that I needed to scratch. Something, but I didn't just know. I started moving in a direction, and I could, at one point I committed to it. I picked it. I went for it, and it worked out. People say I just knew, and sometimes, in some ways, I think they're rewriting history. Right? When you are about to do something big, quit your job, move to another country or state, do something that you've never done before, that you feel like is there's something inside of you that needs to get out into the world. Most of us are shaking in our boots when we're making those decisions, and that's okay. There's a great amount of comfort when you realize most of us don't just know, but we act anyway. I'm often reminded, you know, of people asking this question often, which is, how do you stop feeling afraid? How do you deal with fear? And you don't. You learn to do it afraid. You don't just know. You act anyway, even especially when you're afraid.
Yeah, I think there's probably only a few people I should know. I think of like Tiger Woods. He knew.
Well, his dad helped him. Yeah, no, he knew because he was playing golf at 3 years old.
Exactly.
He was conditioned, but sure.
So what's like the single most important piece of advice you give to somebody who is trying to find their calling or purpose?
The most important advice that I could give to anybody who's trying to figure out what they want to do with their lives, purpose, calling, whatever you want to call it, is to try lots of things. Experiment. It really is trial and error. I love what Parker Palmer says about this. He says, listen to your life. Let it speak to you. And when you listen to your life, you will learn things about yourself. And we listen to our lives by simply paying attention to our stories that we've lived and are living. And so ask yourself, what did I do when I was 10? What did I do when I was 15, 20, 25? What are the themes? What did you learn about yourself through those experiences of trying different things? Parker Palmer says, before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, I need to listen to my life telling me who I am. So it starts with trying things and then listening, paying attention. Everything that happens to you is feedback. I like this. I didn't like this. This worked. It didn't work. This felt good. This didn't feel good. I've always done this. I've always been interested in this. What is that about? Don't try to draw any immediate conclusions from any of these things. Just begin to look for themes and patterns, and the calling will emerge.
That's cool. I feel like you've answered these questions before.
Maybe.
You're doing awesome. You answered that one already. Let's talk a little bit about a portfolio life.
Okay.
So I love the concept of a portfolio life. Can you talk, first of all, define that for people?
Sure.
And then just how it applies to a career or dream.
Mm-hmm. The portfolio life is the idea that you will not do one thing in life, you will do many things, and that your calling, in fact, is a portfolio of different aspects of your life that make you you and make this story that you're living unique. And so what's really great about it is for those of us who have different interests, we're not just that or this or this other thing, we're all these things. There is this freedom to see it all as one thing. Without going, well, should I be the writer guy? Should I be the marketer guy? The video guy? Well, I have all these interests. And yet, you don't have to pick just one thing and be great at it. The one thing that you're great at is maybe combining these two or three different things. And while I believe that you shouldn't try to be a jack of all trades, the goal these days is to become a master of some. And we're seeing more and more studies about why this is a really smart, advantageous way to live and build a career where more and more standard jobs are going away and the demand for freelancers is increasing. I've heard in the next decade, over half of the American population workforce will be freelancers. So you're going to have lots of bosses. You're going to have lots of gigs, whether you like it or not. So you might as well start living a portfolio life today.
Yeah, I love that concept. In your book, I think you have a specific date.
Yeah, I think 2030 is what they say. 2020 is like half. 2030 is like more than half.
Yeah,
60% or something.
I knew there was a specific date.
So yeah, yeah. Yeah, 2020 was the projection by a Forbes study years ago. Yeah. So 2 years.
So regarding portfolio life, how have you implemented that into your own life and career?
So for me, it was really freeing to understand the concept of the portfolio life, which is not a term I coined. I think it was first coined by a business writer named Charles Handy, who's a British guy. And he talks about these different aspects of life. You've got your home life, your work life. You've got stuff that you do maybe for a salary, stuff that you might do for a fee, you know, some sort of side hustle, we might think of it as today. You've got charity work, things that you do for free that help other people. There's play, there's things that you do just to sort of fill yourself up. And it's just understanding that we live life not just, you know, as this sort of monolithic thing. And at the same time, it's not completely segmented, but everything's kind of integrated. And so for me, it was understanding to, it was helpful to understand that all of these aspects of life were important. Because early on, especially starting a business, becoming a writer, in about 6 months, we went from not having any kids to having a kid, having, you know, two full-time jobs down to having no full-time jobs and starting a business. All, you know, all in 6 months, we had a kid, both of us quit our jobs, and I started this business all, you know, at once. So there's a lot of pressure all of a sudden for me to be a breadwinner. And so it's very easy for me to focus on work. Like, that was my thing. That was my calling. I've got to go, 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 do this one thing because that's who I am. And as I began, it wasn't very fulfilling to do that. But as I began to realize that all these different buckets of life were my portfolio, it's allowed me, compelled me, you know, to fill each of those buckets and treat the whole thing as a work of art, as my calling, as this thing that I had to take care of. If you think about even like an investment portfolio, unless, you know, you get the inside scoop on Apple 20 years ago, it's not smart to invest in one company. You know, you're investing in several different kinds of assets. And over time, paying attention to those that are, you know, appreciating and those that aren't, and trying to manage that whole portfolio. And if you do that well, you have something very, very valuable. And I see my life as that. There are these different areas of life that I'm trying to tend to, because they're not different things. It's all one thing, the portfolio that is my life.
So I know you have an assistant because she's been emailing us. How long ago did you get it? Did you realize, okay, I need an assistant?
Very early on, I had somebody come to me. I've had a couple of assistants over the years. Say, I can help you with it. I was like, what do I need help with? And then I launched a book and she's like, I'll do this for you for like free for a few weeks and you'll see. And then I launched a book and I got like hundreds of emails every day. And I was like, okay, I need help. Help me. So yeah, it's been going on for about 6 years now.
Cool. Awesome. You're doing an awesome job. Seriously.
Thanks. Yeah, great. It's fun. I like the off the cuff stuff.
Yeah. So what was the driving force behind your book, Real Artists Don't Starve? And was there specific experiences in your life that inspired it?
So the book Real Artists Don't Starve was inspired, probably the way most books are for me, by conversations, talking to people. And I kept talking to two different groups of people. I live in Nashville, you know, very creative hub. You got a lot of musicians, a lot of aspiring authors, creative entrepreneurs, and it continues to grow in that. And I talked to a lot of musicians and artists. And they would either tell me one of two stories. The first story was, man, things are great. This is amazing. I can't believe I get to make a living doing this. Whatever it was, you know, being, you know, shooting videos, doing visual art, music, writing, whatever. Over the years, I've met some, you know, not necessarily famous people, but successful artists. And then there's this other group of people that I would meet, and they would go, man, I'm struggling, I'm hustling, it's just not working out. Because, you know, there's no money in art. You can't make any money as an artist. So I've got to wait tables and kind of work on my art on the side. And it was just so fascinating because you have two groups of people telling two very different stories about the same thing. So can you make, because people say things like, well, you can't make any money, you know, as an artist, as a musician, as a writer, right? I go, well, you can if that's what you think, right? And so I realized that there are these two very different narratives. One, the narrative of the thriving, successful artist. The other narrative of the starving artist. And so I wanted to write a book about that. And as I was thinking about that, I kind of want to introduce these two groups of people to each other. Starving artists meet thriving artists. It is possible. You don't have to starve. That's the message of the book. And it was around that time that I was introduced to a story about the artist Michelangelo. And I didn't know this. He was the wealthiest artist of the Renaissance. And at his time, he died. He was worth about $50 million in today's currency. And when he died, at that point, he was the wealthiest artist who had ever lived. So that's great. You know, Michelangelo was rich. That's good. He had lots of houses and all kinds of things. But what's amazing is he set a new precedent for the Renaissance. And there were many wealthy artists who followed in his path. And I think there are lots of modern day Michelangelos. I meet them every day. They're not famous. I'm not talking about Taylor Swift. They're successful artists. They have found a way to make a living off of their art. And I call that the new Renaissance. So there are lots of people, lots of thriving artists who are making a new path, a new way for the next generations, next generation of creative professionals.
That's cool. I didn't know that about Michelangelo.
Cool. Yeah, it's wild. It's awesome.
Just curious, who are some of those artists who are just kind of, and this isn't necessarily for this, but just curious.
Well, I mean, I mentioned my friend David Molnar. He's a photographer / videographer, you know, making great money doing that. I met an artist, a visual artist, a painter in Indianapolis, and he does a painting a day. About, you know, they're between $200 and $400. He's a fine artist. But he prices his art cheaply enough that, you know, anybody who has a little bit of cash that cares about art can, you know, put an indie landscape painting in their house, puts it on Instagram, sells two or three paintings a day. He's making, you know, a couple hundred grand a year. The fine artists in Indianapolis hate him because fine art is expensive. You do galleries, and you know these serious paintings have to be between $5,000 and $10,000 a piece. And they'll do these galleries and sell one or two paintings every 6 months. He does a gallery, 120 paintings, $200 to $500 a piece, sells out in two nights. They hate him because he's thinking like an entrepreneur. He's thinking about supply and demand. He goes, I don't care. I'll paint a $400 painting. It doesn't matter to me. I said, how did you get so successful? He said, math. He said, I realized the ideal price per square inch of a canvas. I go, you just have to, I mean, so I, people like that. I mean, they think differently. They don't think about their art necessarily as this precious thing that I hope somebody pays me for someday. They go, I'm going to make this thing. And then how can I make it relevant to other people? How can I find a market for it?
That's cool.
Yeah.
I think this is a concept you touched on too, but why do you think artists are typically undervaluing themselves?
I think artists undervalue themselves because of what I call the myth of the starving artist. So Michelangelo was the richest artist of his time, and he made it normal for artists to be wealthy throughout the Renaissance. But after that came the Romantic period, and there was birthed this idea that artists needed to struggle, that great art came from poverty and struggle. It's just an idea, but it was propagated by things like La Boheme and all these kinds of stories and things that artists would say about themselves. Like Picasso would say, I would like to live as a pauper, but with plenty of money. Well, he did just that. He died with about $500 million to his name. So he lived with plenty of money. So it is just, it's a story that we tell ourselves, and myths are stories that we tell ourselves to help us make sense of the world around us. And some myths are true. But some myths become true when we believe them. And so the myth of the starving artist is a powerful story. It is a story that we're still telling ourselves today in some ways, and it's not necessarily true. It becomes true if you want to believe it. I meet plenty of starving artists that believe that myth and live into it. But all of the thriving artists, the successful creatives that are doing great work, it's great, high quality work, and are getting paid well to do it, they're making a living off of their art, they have decided to tell themselves a different story. And I think maybe not everything is this way, but a lot of life is this way, that whatever story you tell yourself, you end up living out. And so the whole idea of Real Artists Don't Starve is you get to decide today. I mean, this is the best time to do creative work. It really is. More musicians are making great money off of their art because they don't need the record label. They don't need to go gold. They can set up a tribe. They can build an audience of people who want their art and connect with those people and make a living. It is possible. So many of the intermediaries have gone away. But it's only possible if you believe it, believe that it's possible. And if you want to keep telling yourself the story of the starving artist, you can go right ahead and do that too.
Follow my mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So on a personal note, do you remember the very first time you got paid to create art?
Yeah.
And how did that make you feel?
Yeah, the first time I got paid to write something was a friend reached out to me. I was trying to make some side income. Pay for an anniversary ring for my wife or something. You know, we've been married for a couple of years. I started taking on these freelance writing gigs. And the first person who hired me was a friend of mine she was like a marketing consultant, and she was doing this gig for some park outside of Toronto. And I had to write the signage. I had to write the copy for the signs in this national park or whatever it was. And she paid me $100. She sent me the check. I lost the check. I was so embarrassed that I never asked for another check. But it was a big moment where I realized, holy cow, somebody paid me to write. And I did a terrible job. She ended up changing all the words and copy, and I just didn't get it right. But she paid me anyway. I lost the check, and none of it mattered because it was me getting paid to write something, and that had never happened before, and that changed everything.
That's funny. That was hard not to
laugh. Oh man, so many embarrassing stories like that.
Are there any like different personal experiences that maybe even outside of writing and stuff that have helped shape who you are as a person?
How far back do you want me to go?
Where are you going to start?
I think probably one of the biggest lessons that I learned, I don't know, about life and work was from my dad. He was always a hardworking, mostly blue-collar guy. Didn't go to college. Never was like really into education. A smart guy, street smarts guy. Just wasn't into that. And yet, you know, I learned so many great lessons, the best lessons from him. One of which was just about the value of working hard. I was always good at school, and it came pretty easy to me. For most of my childhood, I made straight A's until I got to high school and I realized that the dumb kids were popular. So if I was going to be dumb, if I was going to be popular, I had to be dumb. And so I, you know, kind of bombed some tests to lower my GPA, felt terrible about it, and immediately had to start getting A's again. But I remember before all that, coming home one day and giving my dad my report card. And I was in fifth grade or something, and I had an A minus on the report card, which was still a 4.0. And I said, "Here, Dad, here's my report card." He goes, "What?" He had me go through each grade. What about this? What about this? Like, how did this happen? They're all A's. Then one A minus. And he says, "Tell me about this A minus." I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "It's fine, you know, whatever, and you know, it's pretty easy." And he goes, "But did you try your hardest? Did you do your best?" I said, "Dad, I didn't have to. It's not that hard." He goes, did you do your best? I said, no, I didn't need to. I did the least amount that I had to do, and then I went and played video games. And he said, look, that's not okay. I'm disappointed. I said, Dad, I got an A. It's still a 4.0. It's perfect. He goes, I don't care. He says, I don't care if you come home with an A or a D. If you tried your best, great. But we always try our best. It doesn't matter the result, but we always show up and we do our best. And I never forgot that.
That's cool. How did you remember that specific? So have you written about that?
Maybe a lot, I've hinted at it before. Yeah, I mean, it was a formative lesson. Yeah. And he would say it over and over again. Did you do your best? Did you do your best? Yeah. I mean, it was a lifelong thing.
Very correct.
It was a dad thing that he said. Yeah.
That's cool. That's a cool story. Mm. So can we touch on the Tribe conference a little bit?
Sure.
Because that's definitely a part of your career as well. Can you talk about the Tribe conference and just your vision behind it?
Mm-hmm. So I got into doing events several years ago. We did a small workshop with about a dozen people, met here locally in Franklin. And that was a lot of fun. And I was like, okay, great. We'll do a conference. We'll have hundreds of people come. And it'll be just like this. So easy. And that's how we launched the Tribe Conference and learned a lot about it. But Tribe Conference is an annual event that happens here in Franklin, Tennessee at the factory. And it is an event for writers and creatives to help them hone their message, build a platform, share that message with the world, and get paid for their words, for their message. And we bring together a few hundred people every year. It's a small, intimate, but powerful experience where people realize for the first time in their lives, I'm a writer, I'm an artist, very communal. It's family, and it's not for everyone, but for the people that come to it, it's for them. And it is my favorite weekend of the year. It is a different form of art that I didn't think I would enjoy, facilitating experiences for people, but it's a lot of fun. There's nothing like creating an experience for someone and then watching it unfold. I've written books. I used to play music. I've made art and kind of thrown it out there and eventually gotten some sort of feedback, but to actually create an experience for people, that's really fun. It's a different kind of thing. And it's been one of the most impactful and most gratifying things I've ever done.
That's cool. I can relate. I enjoy it. I've been a part of some different events over the years.
It's stressful, but great. Yeah. It's stressful,
it's
but great.
To,
yeah.
See how I come alive and create an experience. Yeah. I can totally relate to that. That's coming up, right? October?
Yeah. Last weekend of October, right before Halloween.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about Nashville, since this is Get to Know Nashville.
Sure, yeah.
So what brought you here, first of all?
What brought me to Nashville was a girl. In the words of Good Will Hunting, I went to see about a girl. And it worked out. I ended up marrying her. But my wife-to-be, Ashley, moved down here. We're both from Illinois. She moved down here about a dozen years ago, almost 12 years ago. And she wanted to get involved in the music business, working for a record company. And she moved down here, and around the time where I was thinking about like what I was going to do, I was traveling with a band at the time, and around that time, my parents decided to move from northern Illinois to northern Alabama, so like all the signs were pointing me to the south, which I had no interest in, and so I quit the band and moved to Nashville, which is the opposite order in which those things tend to happen. And I moved down here to chase the woman who became my wife. And I discovered all these great things living here. I worked for a nonprofit for a while, worked in a call center for a while, and started meeting all these writers and artists and creatives that I had no idea. I mean, I knew about country music, but I didn't know that there was this incredible community of creatives. And it's only grown since we've lived here. But that's what brought me here.
That's cool. Can you talk a little bit about that community and what's that meant to you and how that's helped shape who you are in your career? And
So I was a writer sitting on my couch every Saturday afternoon, and then I was a marketer the other 6 days of the week. And on writing days, you know, I had a full-time job working for a nonprofit. I would, you know, be sitting in Southeast Nashville in our one-bedroom apartment, writing, dreaming of what it might like be like to be an author someday. And then I would go to social media, I'd finish up writing my amazing piece of prose or something. I'd go to social media, and you know, Facebook, Twitter, and I would just get jealous of these people, and I'd be bitter at them, and I'd go, your writing's not that good, my writing's better. I would, you know, do the thing that you always do when you're jealous at somebody. You try to pick apart their work so you can feel better about yourself. And then one day it dawned on me, I think I was watching some interaction on Twitter, and I saw some blogger slash author person that I looked up to retweeting something from some other blogger author person that I looked up to but also kind of hated, you know, as you do when you're jealous of people. And all these people started commenting, and I realized all these famous people, these people that I looked up to, knew each other. And I realized, well, what's stopping me from knowing those people, from connecting to some of those people? And I realized a lot of these people were hanging out in the same coffee shop every day or whatever, going to this church, being a part of these different scenes. And I thought, well, I'm just sitting here on my couch dreaming of living this life. What would happen if I stepped out of my comfort zone a little bit and at least just started showing up, joining the scene, connecting with people where, you know, they tend to hang out? And just stepping out of my comfort zone, doing that, literally just going and hanging out at coffee shops, not like awkwardly stalking people or anything, but just you start to bump into people, and you also bump into other people who have the same goals and aspirations that you have. And for me, that was the most beneficial part. You know, meeting your heroes, mentors, great, good stuff. The best part is connecting with other people who want to go where you want to go, who are in those coffee shops, a part of that scene too, and realizing you can help and encourage each other and hold one another accountable. I would not be doing what I am today if I never moved to Nashville.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. So I had like four questions about Nashville. You got them all.
Okay, cool.
Killing it.
Yeah.
We're almost done. One thing we like to do at the end is just kind of give an inspiring word for somebody that might be watching. And I think in your case, you know, you talked about calling and all those things. Maybe speak to that person that's chasing that calling, just a word of encouragement. Not necessarily just the writers, but just
the
writers in general.
So one of the things that I've learned about all this stuff, finding your calling, chasing your dream, figuring out what you're supposed to do with your life and going after it, is people are afraid of failure. And I had the fortune of interviewing a lot of people who became very successful in their dreams and were happy and fully alive in the thing that they were doing. And I asked them about failure. And one woman who found her calling later on in life, almost 60 years old, she, you know, through a series of tragic events, realized that she needed to be writing and speaking and doing this thing that had always been in her heart. And finally, life had kind of forced her to do it. And I said, how did you know? Her name was Jody. I said, Jody, how did you know that you were going to succeed? How did you know that this was it? She said, I had no idea. But it was time for me to act when I became more afraid of not trying than I did of failing. And I think sometimes we think fear is a bad thing and you shouldn't feel afraid and don't feel bad. It doesn't work anyway. You still feel afraid. But I don't think fear is necessarily a bad thing. There's good fear. The bad fear is the kind that says, if you do this, you might fail. Okay, that's not helpful. But the good fear is the kind that says, if you don't do this, will you regret this? You know, years later, looking back, will you regret not having tried? Because you're not guaranteed success. But that's not where the fun part is anyway. The fun is in the climb, the journey, the chasing of it, not just the attaining of it. And so if I could say one thing, it would be don't be afraid of failure. Be more afraid of not trying. Oh, good.
20 seconds right there.
Thanks so much for checking out Get to Know Nashville. For more great content like this, visit gtkn.tv and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Get to Know Nashville.